I think it's both a psychological hurdle, and that one is the real thing and one is a replica. And secondly, it's a situation of consumers having to actively choose the alternative versus the choice being made for them by the company that they're buying their taco from.
Welcome to Positive. Find us on Twitter at POSI2IVE. This bi-weekly podcast is for active investors and founders just like you, focused on venture scale positive impacts. I'm your host, Zeka Len, an angel investor in the private capital markets here in sunny SoCal.
Today's guest is Nick Cooney, managing partner at Lever VC, headquartered in New York City. This episode will include three sections. First, meatless origin. Next, consumer motivations. And last, meatless future. Welcome to the show, Nick.
Thanks, Zeka. Thanks for having me on.
Truly my pleasure. Having had a chat with you earlier, I just noted how grateful I am in terms of how generous you are with your time and dedication to the sort of meatless future we're going to break out into. Having said that, can you tell us what is your background in this space?
So I got interested in the space just a bit over 20 years ago when I began eating the products myself. For me, the initial entry into it was because of caring about the sector from personal ethical reasons, believing in the animal welfare, sustainability, and then later the health benefits of these products and these types of food. So that's how I got into it. Been eating these products, things like plant-based meat and dairy, for over 20 years myself at this point. My background from there in terms of getting more directly involved, so I've been working in and around the alternative protein space for a bit over 15 years. Further back, there was more on the NGO policy sides of things. So in a variety of ways, including working with some major companies to help them add these products to their supply chain, and also promoting the sector and products in the sector to consumers in the US, in Latin America, and a bit in Asia as well. And I began investing in the space in 2015. So I've been investing for about 5.5 years at this point, just over 50 deals total in that that period within the alternative protein space.
And I know that you're quite a humble person, but I found it quite remarkable, the deals that you have invested in. I believe you invested both in Impossible and also, what's the other one? I'm getting mixed
up. Beyond Meat being the other crap seg one.
Yeah. I mean, the only earlier startups I suppose you could have gotten into was something like Tofurky or something like that.
Yeah, I would have had to be a lot older. Some of the, you know, those companies have been around 30 to 40 years, and that's about how long I've been around as a human being. But indeed, I didn't invest in Impossible myself, but my partner at Lever VC, Lawrence, he was an early investor in Impossible. And indeed, both myself and he both did investments into Beyond Meat from family office vehicles that we ran or helped run.
You also, I believe, have a background. You started or co-founded the Good Food Institute. Can you tell us more about that story, how it got started, and your experience with it?
Sure. Good Food Institute was founded in 2015. So I was working at an NGO at the time, and in the years prior, we had started thinking about how this plant-based meat and dairy sector, and then the very, at that point, very, very nascent cell-cultivated meat and dairy sector was coming into existence, was growing, and that this was going to be a big thing and something that would have significant value for society. And there was no entity, no trade group, no NGO, et cetera, that was working to grow that sector. So, you know, I spent about 18 months trying to chat with as many people as I could in the sector. So some investors into it, some entrepreneurs, some third-party actors, company heads, et cetera, just to get a better sense of the space and a better sense of what would be helpful to the sector. And so out of that came the decision to launch this entity, Good Food Institute. So I was created out of the NGO that I was working with at the time, so co-founded by myself and one or two other folks there, launched as a freestanding NGO to be able to have that singular focus on growing the alternative protein space. And it's kind of gone from there. So I served as chairman of the board for the first several years, helped hire the first 15 or 20 people, brought on the executive director. And obviously GFI, their team has done a great job since then in providing a lot of value to the space and companies and investors and others in the space, both here in the US and globally. So that's kind of the background of GFI and my previous involvement with it.
to me, it's amazing the level of research. I told you as well in the pre-show that I gravitated to try to find some research to understand this space more, and that name just kept like popping up. It's a source for tremendously great information regarding things like life cycle analyses and other trends in the marketplace and consumer behaviors and such. And I'm really excited to break out into that in the next few sections. A little bit more about your tie to research and your tie to kind of these topical ideas. You wrote three books, I believe, and one was on, I mean, it's quite diverse. Your background is so interesting to me. One is on psychology, on social change and psychology. Another one, veganomics, from 2013. About vegetarians, and then in 2015 you wrote how to be great at doing good, which is social impact geared, etc. I mean, it's just amazing how productive you are and how much you've accomplished. Can you tell me maybe more about the motivations for these books and what led you to want to become an author as well?
So I enjoy writing. I was initially a journalism major in college before shifting, and so I do enjoy the act of writing. The books were all written, I'd say, for very practical reasons. So trying to achieve some specific end rather than self-expression or something along those lines. And each of them, the goal was a bit different. You know, the first book that you mentioned, which is called Change of Heart, I wrote when I was mainly working on the NGO side of things. And so the book was trying to look at the research that's out there on basically hard data around the psychology of persuasion science. And so there had been a number of books written about applying that to life, one's personal life, or to, in some cases, to business. But no one had ever tried to look through that research and think about how can we apply this same research, these same findings, to social causes and to trying to shift society in positive ways. So the goal of the book was to try to go through that research and compile some of the key things that have been learned in that research so that those working to improve society in any way, and it could be in a business context, could be in personal life, although I'd say the book is geared more towards NGOs and those working in that space, how they could apply that to their cause. The second book, which you mentioned, Veganomics, so the goal there was to really understand people who are eating plant-based foods and, again, taking a research-based look at that. So looking at all the studies that had existed at the time, which is I think 400 or 500 at the time that was written, maybe 8 years ago, to get a sense of who these folks are, what motivates them, why do they stick with it or not stick with it, what prevents people from eating those sort of foods, and anything and everything under that umbrella. So that in efforts to promote this category to those consumers, those efforts could be done more successfully by targeting the most receptive audiences, or in any other way that the research would suggest would be more effective. And then the third book, yeah, I'd say that the practical goal there was really to try to, I mean, this was a more opinion, it's definitely much more opinion-based book, whereas the other two are more research-based. I guess the goal of the third one was to get folks who are involved in charity in any way, whether it's making the occasional donation, volunteering with a charity, working for a charity, et cetera. Anyone who's trying to do good through those channels to think in what I would view as a more logical and perhaps more importantly, more rigorous way about how to maximize that, how to take the same bottom line approach that many folks take to business, how to bring that same mentality to things done in the philanthropic sector. I'd say the reason for writing each of those was trying to achieve some practical aim there.
So inspiring from the standpoint of goal setting. Thank you for sharing that. And I can definitely see why you've gravitated toward the area you have in terms of investment. I believe you also mentioned briefly you worked for a family office. Was that in kind of the traditional impact arena?
Yeah, so I began investing in this space in 2015. I helped a U.S. family office set up a private family office investment vehicle to make dedicated investments into this alternative protein space. And so helped run that and make those investments from 2015 through 2018 when I left and began putting together Lever VC, the current fund. So indeed, it was a private vehicle, was indeed a more impact investment-oriented vehicle. But financially, the investments have done extremely well. So Beyond Meat certainly did very, very well. I invested in them in late 2015. But there's also been a good number of other investments there that have done quite well. So on the higher tech side, this would be companies like Memphis Meats, Geltor, Ala Farms. On the plant-based side, companies like Miyoko's, Kite Hill, Alpha, and some others. So yeah, that was the background in terms of that family office vehicle.
I want to go back to alternative proteins, how you mentioned. For me, it's a learning process, obviously. Clean meat versus cellular agriculture versus alternative proteins. The terms tend to jumble together. How do you look at the terminology in terms of like an umbrella?
We use the term alternative protein to refer to any proteins that are replacing animal protein on people's plates, sort of intentionally replacing animal protein. So we would use alternative protein as the bucket term to cover plant-based meat and egg and dairy products, as well as companies producing real animal protein, molecularly identical animal protein, via more modern technologies that remove the need for live animals in the supply chain. So cell-cultivated meat and dairy companies, fermented meat and dairy companies. There's some companies, including one in our portfolio, producing real animal protein in plants. So we use alternative protein as kind of the bucket category there. Within that, I think where we've seen the most variation is on that cell-cultivated side, right? So years ago, this was being called quite pejorative and not really accurate terms like lab-grown meat or things along those lines. Now you hear a wide variety. You hear clean meat, cultivated, cell-cultivated, cell-based, cellular agriculture, a few other things. We typically use the term cultivated meat for two reasons. First, I think it pretty accurately reflects the general process of what's going on, where cells are being cultivated to grow, just as you might cultivate a plant in a greenhouse or in a field or so on. So I think the terminology is pretty accurate there. And then secondly, there has been a number of research studies done looking at which term resonates best with consumers. And yeah, in terms of like clean meat and cultivated meat resonate best with consumers. And so really it's for both of those reasons that we use that cultivated term, as certainly do many others.
Well, that's a great transition because we have in the next section, consumer motivations. And I guess the core question, what are the main considerations consumers have when they purchase cultivated meats or clean meats?
So that's, I think, mainly a question that's TBD because these products are not really on the market yet, with small exceptions. So I think the best we can tell now is from surveys, what do consumers report as the reasons for why they would buy those products as they really start to come onto the market. And so I think that the main motivations are the similar motivations, not exactly identical, but similar motivations to why an increasing number of consumers are choosing plant-based proteins currently. So,
yeah, and I apologize for that because I did confuse plant-based proteins with clean meat. I see the distinction.
Of course, no worries. So, I mean, if we're talking about that, plant-based meat and dairy, it's the average consumer profile is pretty clear. So most people who buy plant-based meat, plant-based dairy, they also consume regular meat, consume regular dairy. There was a study that Beyond Meat and Kroger did about a year and a half back where they looked at, in a particular month, who was buying Beyond Burgers on the shelf or Beyond Beef products. And what they found is that 96% of the people who bought Beyond Meat that month also bought conventional beef that same month. And so there's certainly numerous other studies that have found similar things. So the typical consumer is somebody consumes meat, consumes dairy, but they're adding these plant-based meat and dairy products into their diet primarily for health reasons. So that's far and away the biggest motivation. It's people reducing meat and dairy, adding these plant-based proteins for health reasons. The secondary set of consumers and motivations of those consumers would be ones who have an ethical motivation, either animal welfare or environmental sustainability. And so those represent, the folks who are motivated by those things represent a smaller portion of consumers, a smaller portion of overall sales, although they sometimes are some of the most frequent consumers of these products. So you've got all three of those motivations, but definitely health is number one. And then if we're talking about what surveys are showing for the pending cultivated meat, et cetera, it's pretty similar, except would lean a little more towards the ethical side of things because the health profile is not as different. You can optimize cultivated meat to improve health. You know, you could dial down saturated fat, dial down or dial out entirely cholesterol, increase, say, omega-3 fatty acids, increase protein content. You can do all these different things because you're building it from the cellular level. There's also much less food safety risk with them. So they will certainly be significantly healthier than conventional meat, but perhaps the differences there is not as large as the difference between conventional meat and cultivated meat in terms of things like animal welfare and carbon emissions and things like that.
Yeah. Speaking of which, well, actually, I want to just mention to you that in the course of trying to engage with the audience and feel out kind of where people's interests may lie that follow the show, I asked a broad question. You are interested in clean meats because ... I asked, I love animals or health first, sustainability with a heart, or just kind of show me the pizza. And that's just kind of a joke. But it looks like about 40 out of 17 respondents. So obviously grain of salt here, statistics wise, but sustainability ranked at 41%, health ranked at 35.3%. And then I love animals at 11.8%. And I was quite surprised by that. I thought that the animal portion would be first, but yeah. So it seems in line with what you're mentioning there about sustainability and health.
Yeah. I think that makes sense. And of course, the folks who are more vocal and I think more likely to speak up are probably the ones that are more ethics driven than the consumer base as a whole. But that makes sense, right? I think that there is a lot of folks who for those health or sustainability reasons, aside from the animal welfare benefits, would be attracted to these products for sure.
I do want to kind of address maybe a little bit like the elephant in the room, something like GMOs and or toxicity. I don't want to go way down the rabbit hole there, but before we do, maybe I wanted to mention where I did find some research on the life cycle analysis side from the Good Food Institute. There was the cell-based state of the industry report. I believe that was a 2019 report. There was a kind of a full life cycle analysis that your organization helped create on ecological LCAs and found that feedstock of culture was roughly 1.3 kilograms of feed to every kilogram of culture meat, which is in the broader, like I looked, what is the equivalent in kind of CAFO? It looked like about 7 pounds per kilogram of cultured meat. So it looks like a 7x saving on the feedstock component. So ecologically wise, it seems to be potentially better from land use impact side. On the CO2 basis, it looks like 2 to 7 kilograms of CO2 equivalents per kilogram of cultured meat versus for CAFO or other farming types, 4 to 35 kilograms of CO2 equivalent per kilogram. So from the standpoint of both feedstock and CO2, there's a very significant positive impact from the standpoint of cultured meat. I also tried to look into the water aspects and I wasn't able to get all those answers, et cetera. But another thing I noticed too, that right now cultured meat, if we're not talking about plant-based meat, has roughly 20 to 30 companies that are listed as working in that space on Wikipedia. And they did a cost comparison of about $15 per pound to $3,000 per pound. And yeah, I just found that to be interesting. So a couple of ways I'd like to steer us after having said this. One is some questions that were floated from the audience. If you'd be open to answering, I'd ask them. Is that okay with you?
Of course.
Cool. All right. So Thomas asks about the tipping point for critical mass of clean meat and what that looks like to you from the demand side.
I think that what will, for cultivated meat specifically, I think that what will help it reach a tipping point is the price more than the consumer demand. Obviously, consumer demand has to be there. But the thing about cultivated meat, as distinct from, say, plant-based meat, is it is the real thing. You know, let's say we're in a world, and I don't know how long this time horizon is going to be. It's, you know, it's unclear. But whether it's 10 years from now, 14 years from now, at some point, the expectation is that at least for many meat types, if not all, cultivated meat will be at price parity or very close to price parity or maybe even slightly cheaper. And so let's say we're in that world 12 years from now on beef, where cultivated minced beef is 10% more, same price, 10% less than conventional beef. I think that's what's really going to, even what I'd say if it gets within, you know, 15-ish, 20%, I think that's what's going to open the floodgates for it to really take very significant market share. Because sure, you can have individual consumers who can choose this product on the shelf. So if they're walking down the aisle in the grocery store, they can choose cultivated meat over conventional meat. And if the price is quite close, then you know, some might still choose the conventional version, but a good number will choose the cultivated version for various reasons that we discussed earlier. But I think once you get to that close to price parity or at price parity, what can really shift it is the large corporate buyers. So if you think about, say, a Taco Bell, and they're buying a huge amount of beef. If that beef, if at 12 years in the future or whenever the time may be, they can get cultivated beef for roughly the same price or fairly close to the same price, if not a bit cheaper, what's their incentive for sticking with the conventional version? As long as consumers are happy with cultivated meat, there's no incentive. You get great brand halo with switching to cultivated meat because of all the environmental benefits and animal welfare benefits. You improve the health of your customers because you can optimize the health of the product. Cultivated meat can be optimized on taste parameters as well because you're building it from the cellular level. So you'll probably be able to have a product that tastes even better. You get a stable supply chain without the price fluctuations that you get in animal protein for various reasons. And you get something that sets yourself apart. And you're also probably going to have NGOs and other third sector organizations really pushing these products because of those massive environmental animal welfare health benefits. So I think once the price is close enough to price parity that it's doable for some of the larger corporate buyers, that's, I think, is what's going to really open the floodgates for the market, for the sector. Obviously, all of this presupposes that a sufficient number of consumers are interested in these products. But from the surveys that have been done thus far, it certainly seems like that is the case, that it's quite a significant percentage of the public, both in the US and in other countries, that's open to and interested in these products. And I think that will only go up once they're on the market and people can see it, can taste it, can touch it. It removes any of that, the mystery around it. I think that those numbers will just continue to go up.
Now, is taste and texture, are those the components that are closely associated with, say, a specialty meats such as, I don't know, something that's very difficult to simulate from plant-based, for example, shrimp or, chicken, stringy chicken kind of thing. I imagine with non-GMO plant-based, it would be very difficult to get a similar texture and taste. Are those the types of things that are really going to disrupt, or is it ground beef? Because you do have plant-based alternatives already, I think, being offered at both Burger King, and maybe I heard something about McDonald's or something like that, offering plant-based, possibly?
I think that the plant-based category is definitely going to continue to grow. And for Lever VC, we invest in both of these categories. So I think the plant-based meat and dairy space is certainly going to keep growing. It's growing at a rapid pace now. On the plant-based meat side, it's been roughly 20% on average year over year the past few years, and probably will be the same, if not a bit more this year. So those are definitely going to keep growing. I think the difference is that, you know, to use the Taco Bell scenario that we were talking about, mm-hmm. if Taco Bell is adding plant-based meat to the menu, it's labeled as plant-based meat on the menu, and will require consumers to make a conscious choice to shift.
I see what you're saying there. I understand where you're heading with this. And that's the real kind of crux point for those that associate. It's like a psychological hurdle almost.
Yeah, I think it's both a psychological hurdle, and that one is the real thing and one is a replica. And secondly, it's a situation of consumers having to actively choose the alternative versus the choice being made for them by the company that they're buying their taco from.
Right. I do see what you're saying there. That does seem like a very significant thing. And it's a win-win for everyone, it would seem, because the health aspects and such. Now, tell me about how are GMOs involved in cultivated meats? Is that mostly a concern on the plant-based side, or what are some how is that being mitigated?
This question comes up a lot because there is a technology component to what's being done. I'll answer the question directly, but first kind of to set the accurate way of looking at it, at this within the context of the food industry. Yeah, I mean, most of the packaged products sold at a grocery store have genetically modified ingredients. You know, I believe it's next year. If it's not next year, it's the year after a federal GMO labeling law comes into effect for packaged products at retail. And so once that happens, I mean, everyone's going to see that the majority of things they're putting in their shopping cart, I think most consumers, are going to start having that little label because most of them have GM ingredients. Things like cultivated meat or fermented animal protein that in some cases are using genetic modification, it's no different than the majority of soy in so many products, the majority of wheat in your snacks and cereals and so on, in many of the vegetables that people are eating and so on. So there's really, it's not a change for the average consumer, right? It's going from eating mostly GMO products to continuing to eat mostly GMO products. And certainly the same is true if you think about the animals that we eat. I mean, the level of modification in these animals is so significant. If you look at a chicken on a CAFO versus the wild jungle fowl that chicken came from, you know, it's just been modified so significantly. Different way of modification. It's you know, modifying through artificial selection and breeding, but it's achieving the same thing. It's this dramatically modified creature, and that's true for pretty much all the animal products we're eating, unless you're going off in the woods and shooting a deer or something. So again, even whether you're talking about food as a whole category or whether you're talking about specifically meat or dairy protein. Mm-hmm. There really is no difference there. It's going from animals who have been manipulated and modified and changed extremely significantly in the case of, say, cultivated meat cells, where you have a similar thing just done at the cellular level instead of at the animal as a whole level. So that's kind of the broader context that we're talking about. In terms of your very specific question, so on the plant-based side, other than the fact that, again, most wheat, most soy in this country, most corn is genetically modified, so some companies will use those products and therefore have ingredients that are GM, just like most other food products. If you leave that aside, plant-based, there's no genetic modification going on nearly universally. The only exception to that on the market today is Impossible Foods has one ingredient that is was produced by using genetic modification in the process, not in the final product, but in the process. But that's a singular exception in the space as a whole. If we're talking about the higher tech side of things, like cell cultivated meat, many of those companies, their products are non-genetically modified. So, for example, one of the companies in our portfolio, Mission Barns, based out in California, they're producing cultivated fat, so real fat, real animal fat, pork fat, as well as other types of fat, from using cell cultivation. But they're already they've served the product to consumers. The product's going on sale in the very near future, and it's a non-GM product. It's a completely non-GMO product that's being served to consumers. So there are companies in the cell-cultivated side that are using genetic modification and will sell GM final products to consumers. There's some companies that use GM processes, but the final product is non-GM. And then there's some companies that are completely non-GM, non-GM process, non-GM product. So there really is that variety is out there. And in that case, it too sort of matches what you have in the meat space and what you have in the food space overall.
Moving into our third section on the meatless future, I wonder if you could give me some highlight of the policy areas that are going to impact this broader industry.
I mean, the two main areas are on the plant-based side, it's really just about labeling. Plant-based products use conventional ingredients, at least nearly all of them do up to this point, other than Impossible. And so for purely plant-based products, it's just labeling. And the fights that have been being fought in some states in the U.S. and some countries around the world have been around, can you call a plant-based sausage a sausage? Can you use the word sausage on the pack? Yeah. Can you call almond milk milk on the package? And so in the U.S., most of the attempts by, say, national milk producers or local milk producing organizations or a national cattlemen's association, most attempts in this country to regulate the use of those terms on labels have either failed in the legislature, or they've in some cases been passed, but then been struck down by the courts. So I don't think we're going to have much regulation around those labels in the US. In Europe, it's been a bit more of a patchwork, and you do have some countries that have put more significant labeling restrictions in place. And then the EU has put labeling restrictions in place for some types of products, but not for other types of products in terms. So kind of a patchwork in Europe. And then we haven't seen any regulation around this in most other countries around the world. So on the plant-based side, that's the regulatory question. It's definitely not any sort of existential question. In a worst outcome scenario where some of those terms can't be used, I don't think it has a very significant impact on sales, perhaps a small one, but not a big one. On the cultivated meat, fermented meat, et cetera side, the higher tech side, there is a regulatory pathway there. So companies producing real animal protein in these more novel ways will need to go through regulatory frameworks. So you know, the big news from the past couple of weeks is that we had the first country, namely Singapore, establishing the regulatory pathway and giving regulatory approval for a cultivated meat company just to begin selling cultivated meat in Singapore. This past weekend, it was sold to consumers for the first time ever in the world. And so they're the first country to lay down the regulatory pathway for cell-cultivated. Other countries are working on that, including the US. On the fermented animal protein category, this is a much more established regulatory pathway. And so we do already have a couple companies in the US producing real animal protein via fermentation that have received approval by the FDA. See, that approval is getting a generally recognized as safe or GRAS determination from them and successfully selling those products on the market to consumers. So those are the two areas of regulatory and related issues for the sector. And it's all progressing pretty positively around the world.
And speaking to world standard here, there was a poll put out, and I know it was in Bryant in 2019, but I'm trying to find the link right off the bat, so apologies. But it looks like the US and China and India, people were polled on kind of the percent likelihood that they would be buying clean meats based on a different set of questions. One was kind of familiarity, likelihood of trying. The next was on likelihood of purchasing regularity, likelihood of replacing conventional meat, and likelihood of paying a higher price. In the US, the percentages were kind of ranging from about 10% to 20-25% on all of those likelihoods. But surprisingly, well, I guess I don't know if it's, to me it was surprisingly, but in China and India, the percentages are ranging from roughly 40% to 70% on both the price, the replacing conventional, purchasing regularly and such. And I wonder, are you focusing on international markets currently? Is that where you're heading with your focus?
We are. So Lever VC is indeed investing globally. So if you look at all the studies around cultivated meat and dairy products, depending on the study and the wording and so on, ones from US and Europe have tended to be in the 30 to 50% are interested in the product. When that most basic question is posed to respondents. But would you be interested in trying this product? It's in typically in that 30-ish to 50-ish percent range. But indeed, for the couple of studies that have been done in India and China, for that most general question, it's around 70% that are interested and open to trying these products. So I do think there is more openness to novel foods in Asia, and that's one of the reasons that you see reflected in those surveys. So yes, for Lever VC, you know, we're sector specialists, and that all we invest in is alternative protein. But we are global. We view this as it is a global market. And so we view it as a global opportunity. So we're looking at companies truly everywhere. We view our three main geographic regions as the US, Western Europe, and the Greater China region, because those are both A, by far the largest existing markets for the category, specifically plant-based meat and dairy. And secondly, there is the most deal flow in those regions. But we're looking at companies everywhere. So our current portfolio has, we have seven companies in the US, we have three in Europe, UK, France, and Germany, and we have three in Asia, one mainland China, one Hong Kong, one Singapore. And our next investment is likely to be a company in Latin America. So indeed, we're looking globally, including certainly in Asia, where there's strong consumer interest in this, and the industry is a more nascent stage, but still a lot of consumer interest and a lot of opportunity.
Speaking to founders who may be listening to this show, looking at kind of how do I structure my business to scale, signaling that perhaps the markets may be bigger, smaller, the consumer preferences may be higher, lower, et cetera. How would you look at a U.S. company today that was starting a new company in this space and wanting to scale? Would you be steering them toward those global markets first, or would you be looking at them to kind of advertise U.S. and scale out from there? What are some general things you could throw out for those founders?
I guess it would depend on what product category they're in and also what ties they have to another country or region that would enable them to sell effectively there. I think for certain product categories, certainly some countries are a much tougher market. So, for example, if you're thinking of, I want to create a premium plant-based burger and sell it in the U.S., well, that's, good luck. You've got some very intense competition. On the other hand, there's other countries in the world where that's just pretty wide open at this point. So I think product category is one thing that would matter. And then secondly, what connections they have in another market. Obviously, to effectively sell into another market, you need to know the market, you need to understand what your competition is, and be able to develop relationships with buyers to get your product on shelves and effectively market it to consumers. So, virtually all entrepreneurs are starting companies in the region that they live in, and that makes mm-hmm. obvious sense. But there have been a few who have moved to a new region that they're not as familiar with, but they view it as an area of significant opportunity because of that openness of the space. And I commend them for it. And perhaps a few more should think about doing it and think about if they have the ability to do that effectively.
Are you able to give any kind of shout outs or hat tips to accelerators or incubators in the US or North America, for example, that align with your fund and in line with this industry?
I mean, there's a number of accelerators both here in the US and elsewhere that incubator accelerate companies in this sector. I mean, certainly the one that I think played the absolutely pivotal role of helping launch the cultivated meat space and fermented meat and dairy space is SOS Ventures and their IndieBio accelerator. So most of the early companies in the space came out of IndieBio. Memphis Meats, Geltor, Perfect Day, Clara Foods, and a number of others. And there's one still coming out of it today. So on that higher tech side, I mean, there's no one even close to them. On the plant-based side, say there's a number that either specialize in it or do at least a few companies in the sector. If we're talking about outside in the U.S., there's not one accelerator that over the past number of years we've seen a ton of companies coming out of. Internationally, there's several. So we Lever VC, we partner with an accelerator called Brink, which runs accelerators in several parts of the world, including in Hong Kong and now in mainland China. They're not 100% focused on alternative protein, but it's a significant part of their focus, particularly in Asia. So there's been a number of good companies that have come out of there. We actually launched in conjunction with our partner in mainland China, a accelerator program there called Lever China Fund.
Fantastic.
Yeah, it's a separate sort of sidecar vehicle. It makes investments in very early stage plant-based meat and cultivated meat and dairy companies there. And then companies have, in addition to receiving the funding, they can, if they select to, can go through the Brink Accelerator in Guangzhou in southern China. So I've been trying to do that to help build up the ecosystem there. And I think we'll probably see more of these types of vehicles in other cities and countries in the next couple of years.
Wow, I'm amazed by that. And maybe jumping around just a bit from an ideation standpoint, I was looking into kind of back to the footprint. What would you call it? Traditional meat or just farmed meat? Or I'm sure what would be the traditional term there?
I typically use conventional, but certainly there's a lot of terms you could use. Yeah.
Conventional. I like that. So with conventional meat, there's kind of a different curve for different types of poultry, pork, sheep, beef, etc. Beef has a really high energy use, greenhouse gas, land use, and water use impact components versus sheep being the next, that's about two thirds, and all the way down to cultured meat on all levels seems to be quite low, et cetera. And that difference between all those impact components, I wonder if things like climate tech investors or sustainability minded investors or founders that are aligned with wanting to do some auxiliary service to this industry, for example, offsets through production or something like that. Are there any opportunities you're seeing in that space that would allow an entry of those collaborative types of investments?
So in terms of things like carbon credits, there's nothing in place right now in that regard.
Sadly.
Yeah, indeed. In terms of making direct investments on the private side, so VC or private equity investments, certainly those are there, and certainly there are absolutely a number of investment vehicles or angel investors or funds that are focused on the climate, or that's a key consideration, that are investing in the space. There's definitely a number of investors in both plant-based and cultivated meat companies that are climate-motivated vehicles that are targeting the space specifically for that reason. And I think that's certainly going to continue. On the public side, I don't know this. I don't have something to point to, but I would think it's extremely likely that for the couple companies that have started to publicly list, like Beyond Meat, I would definitely imagine that you have entities that have climate as a part of the concern investing in Beyond Meat as part of their the public equities portfolio. And I think that will certainly continue and grow as there are more publicly listed companies from the space.
Yeah, and I also wonder from the standpoint of corporate targets for greenhouse gas emission reduction, if investing into a company that has a kind of an output per impact that could be offset from the basis of the corporation, they could win both financially and also to their commitments.
I think that's absolutely the case. I mean, if you look at Tesla, which is able to essentially sell carbon credits because their vehicles reduce greenhouse gas emissions, the reduction in greenhouse gas emissions, as well as other environmental externalities.
I was not aware of that. That's interesting.
Yeah, the reduction in those environmental externalities from plant-based meat or in the future cultivated meat and dairy is significantly higher. I mean, it's just significantly greater amount of greenhouse gas reductions in terms of a one-for-one replacement of, say, plant-based meat versus regular meat than if we're talking, say, electric vehicle versus a conventional vehicle. So yeah, hopefully in the not distant future that will exist.
Nick, I'm so grateful that you've really opened my mind to this, the possibility of all the positive impacts. I really appreciate you sharing your passion and your focus on both clean meat and cultured meat. And I really look forward to our next episode if you're open to it.
Of course. And thanks, Eka. Appreciate you having me on, and even more so appreciate you covering this alternative protein sector.
Thank you for that. And for people listening, how can people get in touch with your work and collaborate and support?
Yeah, so as you noted, I'm managing partner with Lever VC. So anyone can search me on LinkedIn, just putting in my name and Lever VC, or you can come to our website, which is just levervc.com, and contact me/us directly through the website. So welcome anyone and everyone to reach out.
Well, happy holidays and success to you and your firm in 2021.
Thanks, Eka. Same to you.
We've had amazing guests on the show, and I'm very grateful for all of your support. The show is now available also on Google. It's available on Amazon. It's available on pretty much all the platforms, iTunes, hosting primarily on Breaker, so you can interact with the show there. We would love any positive feedback you could give. On iTunes especially, leave us a review and keep listening. Appreciate it.